Greek debt talks reach a critical point.
Will the country be able to avoid a messy default?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, January 20th.
Coming up, a country that wants to get into the euro.
Why is General Motors back on top in the world of automakers?
Sticking up for labor unions without using the word union.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We'll start with Greece today, where negotiations are underway with international lenders in an effort to reduce the country's debt. Greece has to make a deal in order to get another round of bailout cash and prevent a messy default. For more, we're joined now by Andrew Walker. He's economics correspondent with the BBC. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Andrew, first bring us up to date on these Greek debt talks and why they matter.
Well, there are reports coming out of Athens that either they have made a deal or at the very least are very close to making a deal. And we know some of the headlines, or at least one key headline, was that they were aiming to get a reduction of 50% in the face value of the debts owed to international banks. And when I say face value, I mean the final repayment when their loan matures. And there's been a lot of difficulty pinning down the details of exactly how much into the future the repayment period should be extended and what interest payments Greece should make to the banks in the meantime. And as I say, the reports are suggesting that they are getting very close. The kind of figures that are coming out of Athens are a delay of 30 years before the final repayment is made, and an average interest payment of something like 4%, with it very much loaded towards the latter period of that repayment time.
Well, lest we get too far into the weeds on this Greek debt stuff, Andrew, yes, tell us why this matters in the grand context of the European debt crisis.
I think everybody recognizes that if Greece is going to avoid a very messy default on its debts, it needs a second bailout. And the European Union governments and the International Monetary Fund have said, yes, we will provide additional money, but the Eurozone governments say only if there is a contribution from the private sector creditors in the shape of some kind of debt relief. So if this debt relief is agreed by those banks, then it does pave the way for a second bailout, which Greece really does badly need.
Okay, stand by while we bring in Chris Lowe, our regular Friday guest. He's chief economist with FTN Financial, and he joins us from New York. Chris, from your perspective, how important are these Greek debt talks?
Good morning, Jeremy. Well, you know, 2 months ago, when I talked to my European economist friends, they were terrified of the prospect of a Greek default. They talked about the first domino falling and a financial crisis which might rip through the European banking system. Since then, they've actually become quite relaxed about the idea.
Why is that?
Well, it's primarily because the European Central Bank, in just the last quarter or so, has put in place several features that essentially ensure that if European banks need cash, they can get it, that they can borrow from the European Central Bank as long as they post collateral. And they actually have some pretty significant deep resources available if needed. And because of that, they say, the pressure is now all on Greece to get this deal done. They think it's actually increased the odds of getting a deal done because, honestly, they don't care if it works or not.
Andrew, quickly back to you. Is that your sense? I mean, do people not care if this works or not?
I wouldn't put it as strongly as that. I mean, I think there is certainly a view in the financial markets that the degree of horror with which a Greek default is viewed has certainly faded quite considerably. But I think an orderly restructuring of its debt rather than a disorderly default when a big repayment comes due in March, I think they'd rather see the first of those two scenarios.
Andrew Walker, economics correspondent for the BBC, and Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy, it's been a rough road for car makers. The economic crash, bankruptcies, recalls, rising gas prices, factory shutdowns because of natural disasters. It's a long and ugly list. But now General Motors has regained its spot as the world's best-selling automaker. It's a story in part about GM's turnaround since being bailed out by the federal government. But it's also a story about the potholes other car makers have hit. For more, we've got Marketplace's Amy Scott with us now. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So is this a story of GM's resurgence or other carmaker struggles?
Well, it's a little of both. For the past few years, Toyota was number one. But of course, Toyota was really affected by the Japanese earthquake and tsunami last March. And that happened just as it was recovering from a wave of recalls and bad publicity. GM has definitely made progress since its bankruptcy in 2009. It's turning a profit. But one analyst told me he doesn't expect GM to make a huge deal about being number one because of the tough conditions for Toyota.
So GM was number one, then not. Toyota was number one, now it's not. Volkswagen says it wants to be number one in a few years. Who's got the advantage going forward?
Yeah, Volkswagen is definitely one to watch. They're doing really well in Europe. They're expanding in Asia. Really, the only market they haven't conquered is here in the U.S. I talked to Ian Henry with Auto Analysis in London. He says, you know, being biggest in sales isn't necessarily best.
It's good for the companies to be able to say we produce the most vehicles, but at the end of the day, I think what really matters is whether they're making profits, and that is probably the more important factor.
And when it comes to profits, Volkswagen is already on top. It overtook Ford in 2010. By 2018, it hopes to be both the biggest and the most profitable.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, that's what's going on in the world of new cars, Jeremy, but more and more people aren't going that route. The average age of a car is actually at an all-time high, and the sale of used models is going strong. So strong, in fact, the demand for gently used vehicles is putting a strain on the people that sell them. They're actually now mining for used cars.
Well, we're about to find out what that is. In today's Midday Extra, we will talk about how exactly you mine for vehicles, and here to do that with us is Bill Visnick, senior analyst with Edmunds.com. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So first of all, tell us what this means, mining for cars. What does that mean?
Well, it's it's kind of an obscure term maybe if you're outside the industry, but it really is exactly what it sounds like. Dealers right now are sort of out there beating the bushes for used cars because the used car market really has dried up with supply. There just aren't enough cars out there to really satisfy the demand.
And how are dealers going about this mining? What are they doing in practice?
Well, there are any number of, sort of programs and various types of activities that dealers do, sort of structured to get at the market. Probably a lot of the listeners have in the past few weeks or in the past year even received a mailing in the mail that said, hey, we really want your used car. We know what your used car is.
Yep.
Or the local dealer may have just sent a very broad sort of a flyer to the house that said, hey, we're really paying a lot of money now for used cars. Why don't you consider coming in and trading yours? So that's really the most common way.
Yeah, actually, Bill, when I bought my car here in Los Angeles, which was less than a year ago, within a month or so, I got a letter from the dealership that said, we'll buy it back for more than we just sold it to you for.
Did you take the deal, Jeremy?
I didn't, because then I'd have to go out and find another car.
That's not uncommon. It happens a lot, particularly in large metro markets that just really don't have the supply of, the turnover of used cars, really, that dealers are looking for. And so that's a quite common story, actually.
And that really gets us to our next question, which is the market for used cars stronger in some parts of the country than others?
Well, absolutely. It is a very regional sort of a business in a lot of ways. Still, it's a big country, and there are a lot of different parts of it. And so, yeah, it is very much a diverse market here right now. And in some parts of the country, there's a more adequate supply of cars overall. But what you also find is that at certain times of the year, let's say it's winter now, you'll find that there's a shortage, let's say, of all-wheel drive SUVs or crossovers in the Northeast, where there's a lot of demand for them right now.
Bill, we had some data that came out last week that said that there was an average age of the car was something like 11 years or something very high historically, right?
That's correct. It's a record high right now, 10.8 years.
So at what point do all these people who are holding on to cars forever and really are in the used car market going to have to upgrade to a new car?
Well, that's the grand question right now. You know, I think it's that pent-up demand that you've probably heard everybody talking about at some point or another over the past couple years as we've come out of the recession. There's this grand question, really, of when this pent-up demand will come into the market. When will buyers have to simply replace their vehicles because they've been holding on to them for so long? The last couple of months of the year in general, except for December, historically are sort of dark months for car sales in the auto industry. And actually, October and November and December were very good new car sales months, sort of bucking the historic trend, if you will, last year. So the belief is that some of that demand is starting to come back into the market, and people have simply, you know, kind of kept their cars too long now and have to replace them, really, almost regardless of what their economic situation is.
And what are you expecting for both the new and used car markets in 2012?
Well, listen, I think it's going to be a very robust market in terms of what we've come to expect relatively in the years after the recession. We're going to be somewhere in the area of probably 13.5 million new car sales this year. And the used car market, I think, is not going to do anything but remain very tight this year, as we still need to really see the new car buyers come back into the market so that the cars they own now end up in the used car pool, so to speak.
Bill Visnick, senior analyst at Edmunds.com, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, if you've ever put together a piece of IKEA furniture, you probably know the frustration of operating those awkward little screwdrivers, but also the appeal, price. Those low prices have helped protect the Swedish company, even in the middle of the European debt crisis. IKEA made a record $4 billion last year. Christopher Worth reports.
Many of us have at least a few things at home that are made by IKEA. I called Matthew Steich, an analyst at the retail consulting firm Planet Retail. He says he does too.
It was pretty much all I could afford.
And he says that's why IKEA is doing so well. When money's tight, people look for bargains. During the global downturn and continuing through the European crisis, IKEA has actually lowered prices, despite the fact that the cost of wood and other raw materials keeps rising. And Steich says IKEA is becoming even more of a global enterprise.
Part of the growth that we're seeing is coming from emerging markets. So last year it opened numerous stores in Russia, finally, and also in China as well.
And now IKEA is eyeing India. Last week, the country opened its markets to big foreign retailers. Add another billion bargain hunters to IKEA's list. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
It's mind-making up time in South Carolina. Tomorrow, Republicans there will vote in the primary. For a lot of people, the deciding factor will be the economy. We've heard from a lot of politicians about their plans to turn things around, but we wanted to talk to folks that actually live the economy there. So we've got Bill Mahoney. He's the CEO of the research and development company SCRA in Columbia, South Carolina. He employs more than 200 people. Good morning.
Good morning, Adrian.
So what's it like to do business in South Carolina?
Well, actually, the business climate is very, very favorable. It's a low-cost, low-tax environment with a lot of connectivity, both digital and physical. As you know, we have one of the most active ports and one of the most extensive highway systems in the Southeast. And so all of the brain power and logistics capability we have forms a very good spot for business.
And what do you think are the biggest hurdles facing the economy right now?
We're struggling with high unemployment, but professional, scientific, and technical employment has grown in South Carolina through the recession. So we may have been affected first by the downturn, but I think we're coming out of the downturn in a pretty aggressive fashion.
Now, as the head of an R&D company with government contracts, what do you make of D.C.'s budget-cutting mood?
Since the Navy is our biggest client, we're a little bit concerned about that. But the defense budget R&D line, which is our leading indicator, looks like it's not going to be cut. We're cautiously optimistic that that will be maintained in the defense budget.
Now, as a CEO, what are you hoping for from our next president?
As a growing business, we want to make sure that both the rules of doing business with the federal government and with corporations are properly regulated but not over-regulated. Part of the reason that we're in business is that we act as an objective trusted agent on behalf of corporations who want to do business with the federal government in the R&D phases. And, you know, frankly, over the last few years, it's gotten more and more difficult to do business with the federal government. So we're hoping for, obviously, proper oversight, but not undue oversight in those transactions.
Bill Mahoney is CEO of SCRA in Columbia, South Carolina. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Adrian.
Well, as Adrian just said, we are just a day away from the South Carolina primary, and the four remaining Republican presidential candidates met for a debate on CNN last night. There was a lot of defense of free markets and unfettered capitalism. Former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum had this to say.
I believe in capitalism, too. I believe in capitalism for everybody. Not necessarily high finance, but capitalism that works for the working men and women of this country who are out there paddling alone in America right now.
Well, let's continue our series of interviews about the candidates now with a conversation about Rick Santorum's economics. Susan Hansen is professor emeritus of political science at the University of Pittsburgh, and she joins us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, unlike some of his rivals, Rick Santorum comes from Pennsylvania. It's a very unusual state in many ways. It's got a very large union presence. It's a manufacturing state. How has that colored his economic philosophy?
Well, I'm not sure it has to any great degree. He remains very, very conservative, was one of the leading people getting the Bush tax cuts passed. He certainly talks about his coal mining grandfather a great deal, but I think his appeal locally was more on the basis of social issues, and I think those factors were really more important.
Before he became a senator from Pennsylvania, Santorum represented Pennsylvania's 18th district, which is right around Pittsburgh. How did he get along with the unions in that area?
Even many union members are strongly pro-gun, pro-life, anti-immigration, and I think he was able to exploit these issues and get at least a share of the union vote.
From a national perspective, we know Rick Santorum, as you say, as someone with very strong stances on social issues. What can you tell us about his economics that we may not know?
Well, the research that I've done has really not revealed anything that would distinguish him from the other candidates to any great degree. And I think Santorum has been much busier burnishing his conservative evangelical credentials rather than pushing economic differences.
Susan Hansen is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh. Professor Hansen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
And you can hear interviews about the economic philosophies of the other GOP candidates. It's all at marketplace.org.
New tech companies are attracting more startup money. A report out today finds venture capitalists are in a spending mood. Funding rose 19% in the last part of 2011. Joining us now to talk about what the spree means for the economy is Jill Schlesinger. She's editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch and joins us every Friday. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So what does this new investment tell us about the economy?
Well, it says that deep-pocketed, sophisticated investors are feeling a little more optimistic about certain parts of the economy. When you look at the numbers, it's really directed at software, biotech, and clean energy companies, too. They're hoping that one of those bets becomes the next Facebook. But I really wouldn't go too crazy because, you know, these numbers of the investments, even though the percentages are big, the actual numbers are pretty small and a drop in the bucket when compared to the total size of the U.S. economy.
Now, could these investments pay off for us?
Well, yes, eventually. Remember that these kinds of investments are usually made with a 5 to 7 year time horizon. So we're not talking about a this year kind of impact on growth or even on jobs. Right now, it's much more important that the European debt crisis is resolved and the general global economic outlook improves Those are the ingredients that are really going to boost confidence and hopefully get the recovery moving quicker. And down the line, those VC investments could add to it. But I wouldn't bet the farm on those investments either.
Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch. Thanks.
Take care.
The AFL-CIO has launched a new ad campaign aimed at boosting the public image of unions. The ads are running in Austin and Pittsburgh and will expand to other cities in the coming months. But as Elizabeth Wynne Johnson reports, the union label is conspicuously absent.
The AFL-CIO's multi-million dollar ad campaign comes at a time when fewer than 12% of private sector workers are unionized.
Work is what shakes us awake every morning and knocks us out every night.
It makes a very warm impression about the people who do work.
But to labor economist Gary Bertless of the Brookings Institution, this ad is just as notable for what it doesn't do.
It does not really mention unions. It didn't link the workers we saw with any direct action that viewers might take.
Contrast that with this United Garment Workers classic.
Look for the union label when you...
Today's image campaign steers well clear of any direct appeals.
Work doesn't separate. It's what binds us together. I teach your kid. You fix my car.
21st century unions may be onto something. Selling collectivism by appealing to individualism. In Washington, I'm Elizabeth Wynne Johnson for Marketplace.
And now, Jeremy, I think we've got to pity those South Carolinian voters we were talking about earlier, at least until tomorrow when the primary election wraps up. According to the AP, 25,000 presidential ads have run in the state.
25,000 commercials on TV?
25,000.
Wow.
That is $12 million worth of vote for me's and I approve this messages. The average TV viewer sees guess how many Romney ads in a day. This is Romney only.
How many?
Six.
Wow.
Six.
And that's just
pro Romney
in however many hours or minutes you're watching TV.
Exactly.
You're
gonna, the average viewer. I kind of feel bad for the local car dealers, though, and the mattress sellers, those guys who are probably struggling to get an advertising word in anywhere.
Pull out those penny stamps. The cost of mailing a letter is going up again. For those of you who've lost count, dropping that thank you note in the mail will now cost you 45 cents. The steady drip, drip, drip of increases has us wondering, are stamps a good deal? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer went to find out.
So maybe you're thinking to yourself, man, 45 cents is a lot for a single stamp. But Postal Service spokesman Dave Partenheimer says, think about what you're getting for your money.
Letter carrier can pick up your letter and deliver it across the country or Alaska, Hawaii, all for just the price of what will be 45 cents. That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Of course, Partenheimer is paid to say things like that, so I decided to do a little street survey down the block from a post office in Washington. People generally thought first-class stamps were a bargain, even with the price hike.
I think stamps are a good deal.
It's still an incredible value.
To send your a piece of mail halfway across the country or all the way across the country for 45 cents, that seems reasonable to me.
That was Margaret Myers, Maurice Walters, and Adrian Coakley. To put their praise of stamp pricing in perspective, we compared it to a cup of joe. Here's Cornell economist Rick Geddes.
The price to mail a letter in 1974 was about the same as a cup of coffee. So it seems as though the coffee prices have run ahead of stamp prices over the years.
Yeah, just a little. When's the last time you got a venti caramel frappuccino for 45 cents? Geddes says stamp prices have pretty much tracked inflation since the 70s. Actually, in 2006, Congress passed a law that says stamp prices can't rise faster than inflation. So yeah, stamps are a good deal. And who can resist a bargain-priced stamp, right? Well...
yeah, I can't remember the last time I used one, to be honest.
That was Adrian Coakley again. And yes, everyone else I talked to said they don't use stamps much either. Of course, stamps are only a bargain if you actually buy them. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
AT&T Wireless is raising prices this weekend on mobile data plans, something that is because of and will affect all you data junkies. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
My name is Jennifer Collins, and I have a problem with data. There's a new app. I want it. There's a hot new post on YouTube. I've got to watch it. thousands of emails a month, you try not responding. Tech analyst Laura DiDio says, I've got a lot of company.
We've just really gotten addicted to using more and more data and applications.
And that's mucking up the wireless works. So AT&T is raising rates on three of its plans about $5 a month. The company is offering more data for your money, but there are still caps. Fran Caulfield is with Insight Research.
Putting limits on the heavy users is a way to stop that flood of traffic.
But how are we supposed to limit ourselves when every day brings more opportunities to download and connect? Again, Laura DiDio.
I don't see the public's appetite for more and more data diminishing anytime soon.
She says companies will just need to boost their ability to keep up with us. Downloading that 12-step app now. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, Adrian, do you play Monopoly?
Sometimes I do.
It's an oldie but a goodie. And you know that old card, I think it's Community Chess, that says bank error in your favor, collect $200?
I never really got the good ones,
oh,
I think.
Oh, you always go directly to jail
exactly.
Was your pick. Well, according to the BBC, there was a real-life bank error in favor of a school teacher in India this week. He was expecting his balance in his account to be around $200. But when he checked his account at an ATM, he found it had $9.8 billion
with
in it, with a B. Yes, indeed. The man called the bank and pointed out the error. I don't know if he took any cash out first, but he called the bank and pointed it out, so I guess he will not be going directly to jail.
Good for that guy.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.